Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with actresses Michelle Hayner and Deborah Eliezer, who star in Roll Call, a double bill, at Fool's Fury at No Space on Mariposa. Director Ben Yalom will also be joining the conversation. I'll also talk with Jack Boulware about the San Francisco's literary festival Litquake Extravaganza, for which we are a media sponsor. It turns 18 this year and starts this weekend. The festival runs through October 14th. From San Francisco Playhouse, we'll meet local director Margot Hall to discuss the regional premiere of Barbecue, with which the theater company opens its 15th season. Barbecue, written by Robert O'Hara, a satire about an intervention at a barbecue. Plus, I'll be talking with flutist Robert Stallman about his upcoming masterclasses and performances in the Bay Area as he visits. And conductor entrepreneur Chad Goodman talks about this Saturday's Elevate Ensemble concert entitled Stravinsky Legacy. I think there might be some ticket giveaways for that as well, so do stay with us. Opening tonight through the 22nd of October at No Space on Mariposa Street, the Fool's Fury Theater Company presents Roll Call, that's R-O-L-E, Call, a world premiere double bill about self-discovery and claiming hard truths, featuring Cheryl, Hamlet and Me, written and performed by Michelle Hayner, and Displaced, written and performed by Deborah Eliezer, both of whom join me in studio to talk about their work, along with director Ben Yalom. Deborah is Fool Fury's co-artistic director in charge of producing new work, a national festival, internship opportunities, and public educational programs. She's been a company member since 2005. With Fool's Fury, Deborah has created and performed in a number of world premieres, as well as directed and choreographed several productions. She has also worked with a number of other theater companies around the area, including Woman's Will, The Puppet Players, and Marin Shakespeare, among many others. She's also a professional voiceover actor and has recorded for Leapfrog Toys, Sims Video Games, and several radio ads as well. She also runs a 33-acre artist retreat in Sonoma County. Boy, lots to talk about with you this afternoon. Welcome to you, Deborah.
Thank you, David.
Michelle Hayner, since 2007, has been a member of Fool's Fury, where she oversees the company's French Plays project dedicated to the translation and production of new French contemporary theater. She trained at Harvard, the Sorbonne, l'École Jacques Lecoq in Paris, as well as UCLA. She also directs and acts. Her TV and film credits include CSI, Dragnet, Deadwood, and a number of independent films. Michelle is also the artistic director of the performing arts program at the French American International School in San Francisco. And you can find out more about her at michellehayner.com, but we're going to be concentrating on her new work for this production of Fool's Fury. Michelle, welcome to you.
Hi, nice to be here.
And Ben Yalom is founder and co-artistic director of Fool's Fury, has directed many Fool's Fury productions. He also has worked with ACT, the Bay Area Playwrights Festival, Magic Theater, among many others, including our good friends at the Aurora Theater and Encore Theater. Ben, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having us again, David.
Of course. Ben, let's first start about with the title of the company, Fool's Fury. How did that title come about?
Well, the funny story is that I was putting on a play in 1998 because I had determined that nobody else was going to hire me to do the play I wanted, and we needed a title. And that play was a Howard Barker play called The Possibilities, and it was very much a very dark look at the world, so dark that I thought it was pretty funny, and we did a buffoon version of it. So I had to come up with a name. I came up with something that was a collision of humor and outrage. And as it turns out, that has been a common theme in most of our work. That's sort of, you know, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. But the storytelling that I like to do and that we seem drawn to as a company are things that combine humor and comedy with hard truths.
Hmm. Have the events of November and this ridiculous year we're experiencing influenced your thought process towards what the company either is presenting at present or will down the road?
Absolutely. I think that the sort of core values remain the same as they were and have been for the 20 years, which is exploration and, again, this juxtaposing of outrage and comedy, but or really outrage and humor. Like, things are so uncomfortable that they make you laugh, and I think that's kind of where we are as a nation in some ways. Mm. But the one thing that really came out of the election was the three of us and our other core member, Brian Livingston, sitting down and really deciding that it was time for us to be making plays that were value-centered, that really asked questions of us in terms of what we value and what we want to present and what we want to explore. And while I think a lot of our plays in the past did that in some ways, now we're really trying to do that by design. And that really brought us directly to these two pieces in Roll Call, in which we sat and worked as artists and thought, what are the questions that are deeply valuable to us and deeply important to explore right now? And Michelle brought a series of questions, and Deborah brought a series of questions that is what these two pieces explore. And mm-hmm. I'll let them talk a bit more about the content of the pieces.
Right. Well, these are very personal stories for both of you. Deborah, let's start with you. It involves your father, and mm-hmm. what I learned, some fascinating statistics just around Arab Jews in mm-hmm. Baghdad and Iraq in general. Can you share with us some of that
information? Yeah, I mean, there were upwards of a million Arab Jews that were living and thriving in different countries, in Morocco and Yemen, and Iraq had the oldest Jewish diaspora, was there for 2,500 years, actually, continuously, and then left within the span of about 10 years. There were 130,000, upwards of 130,000 Jews living very integrated, high-level lifestyle, very integrated in the community lives, and left, and maybe 10,000 remained after, between the time of 1941 and 1952. Yeah, most went to Israel. Some also went to India, actually, which is a whole other play I could write.
So tell us what you're exploring in particularly with your father in this in this work.
Yeah, so my father was born in Iraq in 1930, one of 10 siblings. His father worked at the Alliance Française, was also involved in the government there, in the British, with the British. And so he was a teacher and also worked in communications. And he basically was interviewed by the Jew when both my parents went into the Jewish home, which is a nursing home here in San Francisco, and he was interviewed by the Holocaust Center here in San Francisco, which is now part of the Jewish Family Children's Services, and they interviewed him for a couple of hours about his story. My first question was, why would they be interested in a Middle Eastern man's story? Why would the Holocaust organization? And that kind of reveals my ignorance, really, about the association of Jews in the Middle East during World War II as it relates to what was going on in Europe and the Holocaust in general. And so that kind of, for 8 years, I actually did not watch that video. I was pretty much in denial, like I have to just deal with taking care of my parents and things of contemporary nature. And because I knew that it would uncover more questions, and those questions would need to be answered by me, and that I pretty much knew I would have to write a show about it. So to create a show is like my way of kind of wrestling with those questions of how to integrate all my identities, seen through the lens of my father's story of being in the underground in the Haganah from the time he was 11 years old,
wow.
of witnessing and being a part of what was basically the Iraqi pogrom or Kristallnacht. It was a massacre of Jews that happened in June of 1941, and basically set in motion many events that basically showed us the anti-Semitism that was thriving there for a few years based on the regime and what was happening in the world and the war at that time. So all of these ways of trying to integrate my identity as being Jewish, as being, you know, someone who was the daughter of a Zionist and helped found the country of Israel, also spoke Arabic, lived a thriving culture in Baghdad, and also a woman who is a feminist artist in the Bay Area. How do I integrate all those things? And that's sort of the path that we go on this journey.
So some of this could be interpreted as theater as therapy, at least for you. No, is it involved?
You know, it's
your personal story that you're bringing out, but you're also bringing out a story that should be told.
I think that for us, that was, for me personally, that was my, when I approached it to Ben, I said, please don't let me have a therapy session on stage. This is hopefully not that. What it means to be is to raise questions that actually engage the audience, that will engage and inspire their own stories, their own relationship to displacement, both here in the United States and any country that they are from, or that they, their friends, their relatives, everyone. I mean, it's San Francisco.
Part of the genesis of your creating the work is related to your father's decline, though. Is that correct?
Yes. My father had dementia, and so really, like, what was spurring me was the loss of being able to communicate with him. And so sound and being a professional voiceover plays a big part in that, in terms of the loss of dialects, accents. He was the acting rabbi of our synagogue in Walnut Creek, and he had a style of chanting that was a vocal imprint of where he was from, very specifically Iraqi Jewish. So how to reconcile that loss of sound, that vocal imprint that is lost for many people throughout many countries that are losing accents and dialects on a daily basis, and our relationship to that as a place of home, as we take that with us wherever we go.
Your director was flailing a little bit as part of this, Ben Yellam. So tell me how you helped shape this story and brought it so it is relating to other people as well.
Right. So my flailing was about the theater as therapy concept. I think we're very much, you know, we've been doing this for also 18 years. Hello, Litquake friends. But we're really interested in, you know, thinking about what we provide for the audience. So we're process oriented in that we dig into our personal materials and lives, whether it's this play or other scripted plays, but we really do dig into our own selves for exploration. But when we bring something to stage, by the time it gets to stage, it needs to be a show that is provocative for the audience, that we've looked at what are the connections between what we're putting out there and our stories and what the audience is going to receive and be interested in. And so DeBoer's piece, I tried to help shape it as much as I could, as much as we did together, towards telling her story and her discoveries as truly as an artistic experience, in that they have layered with movement and song and some remarkable work, but it's designed for the audience to engage with and to bring up questions for them that may be useful in their own exploration of their lives or in larger societal questioning of what it means to be displaced when we have a refugee crisis, many around the world right now. It relates directly to those things. I would say that theater as therapy, sure, maybe that happened during the process, but by the time we bring it to stage, that's not a useful thing for anybody else in the world to watch. What our task is as artists is to process all of that personal stuff and spin it into something that becomes a remarkable experience for the audience, not just for ourselves to feel better.
I think one thing I can echo as the co-artistic director is that for us right now, you mentioned the election, David, it's about empathy And the need for what is a citizen artist is what we really were talking about for many months. What is our role and our responsibility to our community? And for us, that kept coming back to personal story and how we share a personal story and personal truth to create empathy, and that empathy can help contradict, perhaps, and positively put out a way for artists and for our community to address what's going on in the world today.
Neat. Indeed, looking forward to this. I should mention, too, that the way that you script the title, Displaced, is very must have some significance, as the dis is in parentheses, as well as the D in displaced. Yeah. So it emphasizes place, but displaced.
Yeah, and how we are all displaced. We all move and grow, and what does that mean? What is displacement for each of us in our heart? Also geographical displacement. And where's home? I do hope that those folks who may be connected to stories of immigration, migration, displacement, people reaching into your synagogues, your JCCs, your social justice communities, affinity groups, will come and reach out to your friends and share this, because the dialogue is really what we're hoping for with this show. Mm-hmm. You know, my story is one story, but the dialogue that ensues thereafter is really what we're going for.
Speaking of which, this is a double bill, so let's get Michelle Haner involved in this conversation. Michelle, your contribution to the double bill is Cheryl, Hamlet, and Me. Sort of a self-discovery going on in there, I understand.
Well, I really, it was lovely to listen to them speaking about this kind of connection between the personal and the universal, and how, our deep personal questions can and should be starting place for creating works of art. But at the end of the day, it's also saying what questions have greater social resonance. What questions really can wake up conversation with the other? So yes, a starting point for this piece was very personal. I'm a woman in my 40s, a contemporary of Sheryl Sandberg. We were freshman dorm mates at Harvard. So a couple of years ago, you know, I put a post-it over my desk, Hamlet, Cheryl, and Me. So, and this was before...
Remind us who Sheryl Sandberg became.
So Sheryl Sandberg, you know, I actually put that post-it up. It was before she had written Lean In, but I had just become aware of her. You know, somebody had sent me a link to her TED Talk about women. And she did this terrific TED Talk, which is really speaking about her position as she's now chief operating officer of Facebook, as a woman who's really become one of the 9% of senior executives in the tech sector. And this experience of what does it take, and her advice to women to lean in. And I heard this and I thought, well, this is so interesting. My colleague of 25 years ago has taken this position really through like the routes of power, of traditionally male-dominated power. And here I am, an artist and an educator, and love my work. And both of us are mothers. And it just sort of created for me a conversation around this sort of question of different paths, different choices. What was my sort of conversation through time and space with this other figure? But I have to say that while that was the real starting point, one thing that's kind of transformed it in these 3 years and the time of working on it, especially since the election, on the one hand, frankly, the rise of digital technology. It wasn't my starting point. The Facebook piece wasn't what drove me into it. But I've been really looking at how digital technology has been impacting my work as an educator, as an artist, how it's penetrating our political cycle. I mean, I feel like Hillary in the mix as women in power.
Uh-huh. So how does Hamlet figure into the equation?
Oh, Hamlet. Well, this is where I almost like have a smile over to Ben Yalom. Ben Yalom, who, you know, I just want to mention, it's a solo project that could not exist outside of an ensemble. Great work in theater comes through a collaborative process. We've been collaborating for 30 years, almost 25. I discovered Hamlet in a little studio in Paris, and Ben was there. And in 1998, when he was starting off Fool's Fury, I crashed at his place. And I was preparing a Hamlet monologue, because I'd been working on Hamlet. Ben coached me on that. So Hamlet, for me, has been sort of like a thread of great character, great conversation. We all have them, these great literary figures or that navigate their way through our lives, that are sort of part of what enrich us, inform us. To me, you know, what is art? Art means that Shakespeare is in the room, and part of my life's thread is being in conversation with this wonderful artist, William Shakespeare, through the character of Hamlet. So he's in the mix.
Interesting. Ben, what did you? How did you help shape Michelle's concept?
Well, as Michelle said, both of these pieces were really, we used techniques that we do for creating ensemble pieces, but in the service of two plays that are largely solo pieces on stage. So we'd spent much time in the studio with Deborah and with Brian and Michelle and myself, experimenting, doing improv, making compositions, etc., to create the world. And what Michelle may not have pointed out is that the wonderful conceit of her play is that there is a dialogue between Hayner, her alter ego, and Sheryl Sandberg, but that Hamlet is basically the mediator, the interlocutor for both of them. So Hamlet is very much alive and well in the 21st century. And I would say that the way that I tend to work as a director and that we tend to work as an ensemble in creating these pieces and elsewhere is that I create a framework for them and I create little experiments. Try this, sit down and write this. Let's see a scene between the two of you doing X, Y, or Z. So I'm a prompter and a nudger in a way. And sometimes I give a little assignment and then I go have a cup of coffee because they're going to do the beautiful work and I'm going to come in and sort of say, oh, well, what do we do next with that? So that was a lot of my work on both of these pieces.
Nudger in chief.
Nudger in chief, yeah.
Ben Yalom is directing the double bill of Roll Call, R-O-L-E call. It's at the No Space Theater on Mariposa Street. Cheryl Hamlet and Me, written and performed by Michelle Hayner, and Displaced, written by and performed by Deborah Eliezer. Deborah, we're going to go out with some original music that's been created for Displaced. Tell us a little bit about the oud and this particular piece.
Well, the oud is very, very much connected to the Middle East in general, but specifically Iraq. And Rachel Valfer, who is my musician and a composer with this piece, really brought to life what I had been imagining, the voice of the land actually for the theme of the show. And so what you'll hear is what I sing as we begin the piece.
Deborah, Ben, Michelle, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, David.
Thank you for having us.
While you're listening to this beautiful music, we do have a ticket giveaway for any performance you'd like, particularly this weekend as it opens, for Roll Call. Call 415-841-4134. Performances start tonight. It runs through the 22nd. This No Space is at 2840 Mariposa Street here in San Francisco. 415-841-4134 if you're interested in catching these self-discovering, interesting double bill Roll Call at the No Space. Still to come, I'll be talking with flutist Robert Stallman briefly about his Bay Area appearances. Chad Goodman talks about Elevate Ensemble. You'll hear about the San Francisco Playhouse's production of Barbecue shortly, and about the extremely prolific Litquake 2017. Stay with us. Thank you. music of the Oud that you'll hear as part of Displaced, the double bill of Roll Call, R-O-L-E, Call. And that's music that'll be heard in Deborah Eliezer's piece. Now through the 22nd, information at foolsfury.org. San Francisco Playhouse opens its 15th season with the Bay Area premiere of Barbecue by Robert O'Hara. In essence, the story is about a hard-partying, foul-mouthed O'Mallory family staging an intervention for their drug-addicted sister, Barbara, inspired by a plan hatched on reality TV. Margot Hall is an award-winning actor, director, and playwright. She's performed and directed in theaters throughout the Bay Area and is a founding member of Campo Santo, where her debut as director for the world premiere of Joyride, from the novel by Greg Saris, won the Critics Circle Award and SF Weekly Black Box Award for Best Director. She's also a professor at Chabot College. For this production, interestingly enough, she both acts as one of two Barbaras, more on that in a minute, and she is directing the production as well. Margot, welcome to Open Air.
Hi, good to be here.
This, I have to say, I saw the show last night, and it is just a riotous, fun, provocative, extremely clever work. Tell us first about the playwright, Robert O'Hara. He's
yes.
new to me.
Robert O'Hara is an amazing playwright, and I came to know his work many years ago. Actually, there was a play done called Insurrection, Holding History at ACT. It was directed by Charles Randolph Wright. And I was lucky enough to assist Charles as the assistant director on the piece. And it was this crazy piece about Nat Turner. And it was very interesting that it was done at ACT. And I got to meet Robert O'Hara, just a dynamic young playwright who just likes to turn you upside down with his work. He once said that if there are any pots to pick at, he's going to turn them all over, or one of those sayings. He also says that he doesn't write theater unless you can choke on it. And so I was so excited from the first page of reading Barbecue. I could not stop laughing. And I thought, oh, my God, I have to do this play.
I haven't laughed so much at SF Playhouse in a long, yes. long time. And it's going to be hard to have our conversation here because I don't want to give anything away.
Yes, that's the thing.
Because part of it is just these shocking reveals and these changes that are really just eye-popping.
Yes. I mean,
so what can we tell people about these families?
Well, what we can say is that it's a dark satire, which I think is really brilliant of Robert O'Hara, because if you mix comedy and satire, you can have the, you know, uproarious fun of it all, but also cut like a knife. And I think he does that really well in the way he structures the piece and in the way, like you said, the reveals happen and they just keep coming and coming. And it's really best to not know what's going to happen, because you are always at the edge of your seat and you're always trying in your mind to figure it out. And it's like, I just can't figure it out. I'm just going to sit back here and let it happen to me. And I think that's what works with this play.
And what's interesting, I thought, about your character, Barbara, is that really this is the story of, without giving away too much, a dual cast of trailer trash types. Everyone has some sort of an addiction or yes. a problem or a history. And yet, when Barbara comes on, she seems to be the most put together of all the characters. I'm wondering if that's intentional in your directing of that particular character, the one that is supposed to be having been sent off to an intervention somewhere. She comes across as being pretty together comparatively to the rest of the family.
Yeah, she's really good at showing that side of her, because she is a Hollywood actress. So it's said many times in the play, it's all lies. So you have to think about everyone and the cover that they put on to get what they want. And I feel like with money, a lot of things can be covered up. And do you see Barbara, what we call Black Barbara, that's all I'll say about that, come into the picture totally put together. And then later, she reveals that she's not as perfect as she seems.
Well, we have to talk about her nickname, which every time I heard it, I just laughed out loud. Her nickname, Barbara, is Zippity Boom.
Zippity Boom.
And as her brother explains it, there's no doodah in Zippity Boom.
Right.
It's Zippity, no
right.
doodah, and then boom,
zippity
because
boom.
The Zippity
no
is...
No Zippity doodah, but Zippity Boom.
And part of the reason for the intervention is the Zippity, right?
So she's, yes, she goes Zippity and then boom. And she has been known for carrying razor blades in her teeth. She has been known for doing a lot of crazy, wild things. And I think the family, in the midst of this intervention, loves her so much and also just doesn't know how to do this type of thing. They look at reality TV to give them an idea of how to cope, which, unfortunately, I think a lot of people are looking to reality TV. So you get a taste of that. And it, I think the play also challenges you to deal with your own ideas around racial stereotypes, around addiction, and gives you an opportunity to also laugh a little at yourself sometimes and your own beliefs.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the challenges of being both an actress in the production and directing yourself as well as your castmates.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I was kind of surprised when Bill said, I think you should do both. And I said, really? Because when I initially read the script, I thought, oh, it'd be great to play Barbara, but I'm going to direct it. And then he said, well, why can't you just do both? And I said, yeah, why can't I? So the challenges around it were basically trying to keep focus. I really have an amazing team of artists. And because they're so good at what they do, I could get them set up, block that scene, and have them up and running, and still have some time to work on my own scene. And I applaud them for that because they helped me make it through. During tech, it was interesting because I would be dressed as my character and I would be sitting out in the audience during previews, and people would be saying, well, isn't that Margot sitting in the audience? And then next thing you know, you'd see me on stage. So I have like this dual role of being witnessing all of the event and then being a part of the event, which is super exciting. And I don't know if I would do it again, just basically because it's a lot of work. But I'm telling you, I'm having a ball doing it.
Margot Hall, acting and directing Barbecue, the San Francisco Playhouse Bay Area premiere of the work by Robert O'Hara. Can't give away too much, but there's so much that you will really enjoy this opening of the 15th season of SF Playhouse. SFPlayhouse.org for more information. Barbecue runs through November 11th. I think I'm going to end with a quote of Robert O'Hara from a talk he gave when the show was premiered down at the Geffen in L.A.
Yes.
The question was, he made a daring decision to upend audience expectations at the first act curtain. And it really is a shocker as you go
yes.
off to intermission. And he says, well, what the hell is a first act curtain created for if not to upend expectations? Who wants to see a show that ends its first act exactly as expected? Why stay for the second act if the first act led to exactly what you were expecting? Why on earth would I be a writer to create stories that folks expect? So it's the whole second act is really takes you on a different journey.
Totally different journey. Yeah, fascinating play.
I wish you a fantastic run.
Thank you so much for coming to see the show.
Of course. SFPlayhouse.org for more information about Barbecue, directed and starring Margot Hall, as well as a wonderful supporting cast. A couple of families involved. That's all I'm going to tell you, but it's a wonderful opener for SF Playhouse. Well, Litquake 2017, we should start with an advertisement of sorts. KLW is a media sponsor for Litquake, presenting Parsing the President, an examination of aspects of President Trump's irrational behavior. Senator Barbara Boxer addresses his political naivete. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg parses his verbal tics. Psychiatrist Dr. Dee Mosbacher sheds light on his mental state. And comedian Will Durst talks about finding humor in this rather unfunny crisis. It'll be moderated by journalist and author David Talbot on Thursday, October 12th at 8 here in San Francisco. Information at litquake.org. Now, that's something that we've been reading here on KLW for a couple of weeks now, along with some other Litquake highlights. But I'm very honored to be joined in studio by the co-founder of Litquake, Jack Boulware. It's a pleasure to have him talk about this amazing list of it's a true booklet of things that are happening for Litquake 2017. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the one that I just talked about. That sounds like a really interesting event, parsing the president. Tell us about how that came together.
Well, we have our festival actually does year-round programming as well. We're a literary nonprofit, and as soon as the election went the way it did in November, we thought we had to do something. So we created a year-long series of events held at the San Francisco Public Library called No Shadow Without Light. That's referencing a Margaret Atwood quote. And we just convened certain evenings where people of different sort of genres responded to Trump. So the first one was the night before the inauguration, and it was packed. And we thought, and the poet laureate of San Francisco, Alejandro Murguia, lit his poem on fire at the library. That was interesting. And so we started doing events throughout the year. And so we had political cartoonists, we had immigrant voices, we had environmental writers, we had journalists. So when it came time for the festival, we thought, well, we have to do something. There's going to be a lot of stuff about Trump in the fall. A lot of books are coming out, but we didn't really want to, I don't know.
It's
just
a book tour.
Some of those books, like you, some of them will have information you haven't heard before, but, we all are glued to the news constantly. We're always looking at our phones. Every day people are discussing, did you see what he did today? So we thought, why don't we drill down and really discuss, his mental state and from a variety of angles. And so that's how that event came about.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that starts things off, or actually on the second day of the festival, is a 12 to 2 p.m. Barbary Coast prostitute walking tour.
That's really popular with the media, I've noticed.
Oh, really?
Everyone in the media really wants to mention that story, that event. Yes, there was a book published last year about the history of prostitution in the Barbary Coast, published by Heyday Books. And so we thought it would be fun to have the authors do a walking tour of the Barbary Coast, what's left of it in North Beach. And so, yeah, so that's very popular.
And tell us a little bit about the Lit Crawls. What are those all about?
The Lit Crawl is it's one night. It features 400 to 500 authors in 103 events through the Mission District. And so people are jaywalking all over the place. Every event is free. It goes from 5 to 9 p.m. And it's the most...
it's the SantaCon equivalent for Litquake or something.
Well, somebody else compared it to SantaCon, but I think SantaCon is a little more belligerent. Willfully so. And it's a chance for, girls to dress up as like Santas or elves or whatever. But this is... these are literary geeks. I mean, we don't leave the house much, but when we do, it's always interesting. You pour a little alcohol on top of it and a lot of socializing. So there's so much variety. I couldn't even begin to tell you all the different types of events that are in the Lit Crawl, but it is the most diverse swath you'll ever see. It's really incredible.
Well, it's hard to pick out some favorites of the festival, but I'm hoping you can offer a couple of highlights that you're looking for.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. we have, this year for the first time, we inaugurated a five-night series of international programs, and those are primarily held at the Swedish American Hall. But we're also doing so there's an evening devoted to Pablo Neruda. There's two new books about him. There's an evening which celebrates 50 years of 100 years of solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. There's a night of poets from Ireland. There's a night of poetry and literature and translation from Brazil. There's a night of international nonfiction. We also have a night of novelists from Europe. And we're screening a film that's fascinating. It's a film that was created by two filmmakers in Germany, and they'd seen a 3-minute video on YouTube of some refugees floating in the ocean, and so they downloaded that 3-minute video, looped it into a 90-minute feature film, and wrote dialogue that appears off camera. And it's something called slow fiction or slow cinema. It's like a new sort of a genre that's kind of popping up. And so we'll have a screening of that film with the director and the writer. So the project ended up being both a film and a book. Quite unique. Never seen anything like it.
Well, a couple of interesting things are happening on Friday the 13th that caught my eye. One is called Bad Rabbi, Strange but True Stories from the Yiddish Press. And that'll be at the Contemporary Jewish Museum on Mission Street, which is a free event with museum admission.
Right. Bad Rabbi is a collection of stories from Yiddish newspapers in the East Coast in the early 20th century. And it was put together by an author in New York, and the Stanford Press actually published it, Stanford University Press. And that's how we found out about it. So we're bringing him out here, and he's going to talk about bad rabbis and all sorts of things.
Also on Friday the 13th, later in the evening, Waiting for the Punch, Mark Maron with Brendan McDonald at the Alamo's Draft House Cinema at New Mission.
Right. Brendan is actually the producer of Mark's podcast show. And this is a new book they have that is a collection of transcripts from their podcast, WTF. Can we say that?
Sure.
Okay. It's about to sell out, so if people are interested, they should get their tickets as soon as possible.
Also on the date that you're parsing the president, there's a companion event called Tech in the Age of Trump from 7 to 9 at City Lights Booksellers on Columbus Avenue.
Right. That's a launch of a new publication called Logic, which is put together by a bunch of local people who are familiar with the tech world, and they're having their own particular take on that. We also have another tech event a few days earlier. It is it explores the history of Silicon Valley from the female perspective. And it features a woman named Ellen Ullman, who has just published a memoir about her days as an early coder in Silicon Valley. Very unique. And it's called Coding, Crunching, and Changing the World. And she's going to be in conversation with Leslie Berlin, who is a historian in Silicon Valley, about the valley itself.
And there's some highlights for kids as well. It's not just for the adult literature, so to speak.
That's true. We have a number of events for teens and kids. Actually, Kid Quake, the first day just ended. We run those for two mornings at the San Francisco Public Library. Those are registration only, so you won't be able to see those. But we do have Jean Yang, who is America's ambassador for children's literature. He actually lives here in the Bay Area, and he's going to be doing a free event on October 14th. On a Saturday afternoon at the American Bookbinders Museum, and he's a cartoonist. He's great. People love him, so we're really happy to have him.
It's amazing the way Litquake has grown over the years. Is this any surprise to you? Is there that the hunger for hearing authors and their works in the Bay Area?
I'm glad that people are still paying attention to the written word. There's obviously a variety of distractions for all of us.
Yeah.
And certainly, there's a lot going on in the city in October. But we never dreamed it would last more than 1 year. We just, did it 18 years ago in Golden Gate Park, and we thought, well, that was fun. Let's go back to our lives. But, there was a very interesting sort of demand for it or hunger for it. I think maybe we created some interest. I love when people come up to us and say, because I went to one of your events, I ended up writing a book. That's sort of the highest praise I feel. We've done something right.
That's tremendous.
That happened.
Litquake.org for the comprehensive guide. You can also get a print version of that. Litquake.org for the 2017 Festival of Literature and All Things Literary. Thanks so much for coming in, Jack.
Oh, thank you so much. And thanks for helping promote it on the air.
We are a media sponsor for Litquake 2017. More at litquake.org. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
Touch of Mozart by my next guest by phone, Robert Stallman, flutist. Also, you're hearing Isabelle Chapuis in the background for some Mozart arrangement of the Concertante. Robert Stallman, such a pleasure to have you back in my studios, if by phone. I wish you could be with me in person.
Well, I know. I wish I could be there. David, great to be able to chat with you. And thanks for having me on. Yeah, now that was a performance, a live performance, I believe, with piano. And you've heard the recorded version with orchestra of that, what I call Sinfonia Concertante in D major, Mozart, that was originally a piano sonata for two pianos. But anyway, ask me a question and maybe I'll have an answer.
Well, boy, this has been a busy year for you. How many publications do you have out this year?
Well, this year was kind of unusual. I hooked up with a new publishing house in Copenhagen called Switzer Editions, run by a Norwegian who lives in Sweden, and his business is in Copenhagen, and the designer is in Rio de Janeiro, and I'm in Massachusetts. So it all came together. I put out 8 editions with them of Schubert, Mozart, 3 rondos, and 3 works of Ravel, including the Alberetto del Grazioso and the Sonatine, which is our new, exciting flute sonata by Ravel.
Nice.
I know you're going to want to play it.
Oh, no kidding.
You'll sound great on it.
Well, you're very kind. Yeah, it'd be nice to have some live trios with the three of us, you, Isabelle, and me.
Well, we'll do that again. We'll have to just plan it better.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, let's talk about the 4 appearances that you're doing here in the Bay Area. Starting off this Saturday, you're doing a solo recital along with Isabelle chiming
that's
in.
That's right. And with Dimitri Kogan, who's a fabulous pianist, whom I always have been working with for the past...
What will you be performing with Isabelle?
We're doing, I always include some of my new recreations or transcriptions. Some are published and some are not. But we're opening up with the Mozart Rondo in D, which is well known by pianists. And that's the published work. And then there's this very beautiful and never seldom played work by the French composer Jean Alain, A-L-A-I-N, who sadly was killed at age... I think it was, something like 20, 29 or in his 20s in World War II at the very beginning of the war. So he left very little music, but it's very affecting, and it's 3 movements. And then we're ending the first half with the Walter Piston Sonata, which I used to play all the time when I was younger. And I said, well, I'm just going to dare do this again, because it's rather challenging.
Well, we'll have a little bit of the adagio that we've caught online of the piston in just a moment. But first concert's also including, how can it be, a Schubert world premiere?
Yes.
Tell us about
that. I call
that.
This recital fantasy, which you can interpret various ways, but the idea of imagination and fantasy and music, especially in the slow movements. Now, this was another, is another of my more recent recreations. Schubert's rather well-known, famous work, it's a late one, he wrote for piano four hands, and there's two people playing piano at the same instrument. It's called The Fantasy in F Minor, and has a very Hungarian flavor to it. It's very kind of sad, but it ends in a triumphant way. But it starts off very plaintive and sad. And I had made an arrangement originally for quintet, for flute, violin, two violas, and cello, or a string quintet, either way, two violins, two violas, cello. And had never had a chance to perform it, but I read through it that way. And then I thought, I'm turning all these quartets that I've done over the years of Mozart and Schubert and Dvorak, the ones that'll work, I'm going to turn them into sonatas for flute and piano, or for two flutes and piano. They're more viable that way, and I can get maybe get them published more. So I turned this Schubert work into a work, I think it was last year or so, for two flutes and piano. And I think it really cooks. I think it kind of works. at least I think so.
Well, we'll be the judge of that, or the audience members will.
It gives a pianist a lot to do because he or she has to play basically an extra part, but it works anyway. So that's there, and we're ending the whole program with Chopin. That's my other publication. I did a whole book, my fourth collection with Carl Fischer, and the Chopin book came out in August. And I'm doing two of the nocturnes. They're in that book, I'll get you a copy, but there are 10 waltzes and 10 nocturnes. And the nocturnes especially work so well on flute.
Nice.
For the obvious reason that it's a lyrical instrument.
Also part of your appearances here will be two master classes on October 8th and October 15th. Another solo recital next Saturday called
yes.
Roots, also with Isabel and Dimitri. And then a further performance at the in Piedmont at the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute on
Gauss Street. That's right, and that's a new one for me. Is that pronounced Gauss Way or Gauss Way? I don't know.
I think Gauss. Let's say Gauss.
It's
rhymes
Gauss
with
Way,
Strauss. That's the way to go, I think.
I'm told it's up on the ridge above Berkeley with a fantastic view. I've seen a picture. The hall looks beautiful.
Well, you picked a beautiful weekend.
So I'm doing that with Dimitri. It's a short recital. It starts at a weird time, 5:15 p.m. on Tuesday, October 17. And I believe it's open to the public, no admission charge.
Very nice.
So,
well, Robert, it's always
on the air, and people might, you know. It's a small hall. It seats about 150 or something.
Where's the best place to go for more information about your appearances here this weekend and next?
Well, online. Go to my website, which is robertstallman.com, and you'll find a posting there. You'll find postings of Judy Quinn is our manager, Quinn. And I'll give her email. It's 123, Judy Quinn, one word, Judy Quinn, 123, at gmail.com.
Virtuoso Robert Stallman will be appearing this and next week here in Bay Area venues, along with Isabel Chapuis, who is the principal flutist of the San Jose Opera. Robert, always a pleasure to talk with you, and let's make sure your next visit, which I'm sure will be impending, we'll have some quality time together.
So too, David.
Cheers.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure, we'll have some Piston in the background.
Oh, okay, Walter Piston.
Okay, so let's... Well, some more tickets to give away next here on KLW. Elevate Ensemble presents a Stravinsky tribute, which includes music not only of Stravinsky, a concert version of The Soldier's Tale, but works by Christopher Cerrone, Julie Barwick, and Gordon Stout. The Elevate Ensemble is the brainchild of my next guest, Chad Goodman, who not only is a virtuoso trumpeter in his own right, but he's a... excellent conductor. He's assistant conductor of the Peninsula Symphony, and I've had the good fortune to play under his baton and experience some of his extraordinary musicianship. Chad, welcome to Open Air for this ever so brief little push for Elevate Ensemble's concert on Saturday.
Thank you so much for having me, David. I really appreciate it.
Sure. So tell me about how this concept of program came together.
So Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale has had a profound impact on composers throughout history. It was a piece written for such a small, compact ensemble of only 7 players. He used it as a way of being able to pay himself and a few musicians for his works in 1918 when the piece was premiered, at the height of World War I, when full symphonies and ballets weren't around to be performing his music. So this is his loophole, in a way, of being able to support himself financially through his music. And so I formed a program that includes the suite from Soldier's Tale, and then we commissioned our composer-in-residence, Bay Area composer Julie Barwick, to write a new septet for the same instrumentation that takes inspiration from Stravinsky.
Very nice. While we're in the final moments of the program, we do want to offer some tickets to this Saturday's concert. It's at 8 p.m. at the Conservatory. Call 415-841-4134. We have a number of pairs of tickets available to you. The concert's at 8 at the Conservatory, the Elevate Ensemble. So Elevate's been going for a few years now.
Yes, this is the start of our 4th concert season.
On this program, I mentioned that Gordon Stout's Astral Dance is on the program. Gordon was a teacher at Ithaca College when I was at Ithaca. I think he's still there.
Oh, my goodness, that's a small world. Yeah.
So what is Astral Dance all about? How does that fit in?
Astral Dance is going to feature our percussionist. It's a marimba solo. And basically, the piece itself has this otherworldly quality to it, which I think many of us connect with Stravinsky, in particular the music of Soldier's Tale, which sort of falls between the cracks of reality and fantasy. And so we found that this that Astral Dance by Gordon Stout sort of aligns very well with the program. Mm-hmm.
You've been associated with several prominent ensembles here in the Bay Area. Is that how you're finding the core of your Elevate Ensemble?
Yeah, you know, I started by freelancing with a lot of the orchestras around here as a trumpet player and met so many amazing musicians along the way. And then when I formed Elevate, I realized, oh my goodness, I have so many incredible colleagues, and this will be an opportunity for all of us to get together and feature new music and local music, more importantly. Mm-hmm. So it's been a great opportunity for all of us.
Well, this concert on Saturday, again, if you're interested in tickets, we have some complimentary tickets to you when you call 415-841-4134. So is it just an octet? What's the full number of players you have?
It's just 7. It's a septet. It includes violin, bass, clarinet, bassoon, trumpet, trombone, and percussion.
Very nice. Chad Goodman, director of the Elevate Ensemble, Saturday at the Conservatory of Music here in San Francisco. Tickets, if you're interested, 415-841-4134. We have several pairs of complimentary tickets. Chad, thanks for coming in. We'll have you come in to talk about some other events that are in your life soon.
I look forward to it.
All right. You've been listening to Open Air here on KALW. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. Our producer is Niels Swinkels. If you've got a show suggestion, by all means, send me an email, david@kalw.org. Hearing some Stravinsky in the background to round out this week's show. Next week, I'll be out of town actually performing in Washington, D.C. for a tribute to Irish poet patriots at the National Cathedral. So I'm going to spend a little time in D.C. Jen Chen will be taking over for me next week, and Peter Robinson will have his regular contribution for that. Thanks for tuning in. And again, if you're interested in tickets to the Elevate Ensemble for Saturday, 415-841-4134. Thanks for listening.